This is Car Expert.
Tesla Model 3 for the same money as a Kia Niro? God, you're kidding me, right?
There's a huge amount of crossover between the spec sheet of the 1500 and of the S-Class we drove recently.
The best thing that the 300 series is going to do is it's going to restore a bit of normality. It's going to take away that silly hyperinflated market that we've been seeing.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Mike Costello.
G'day, Mandy. How are you?
Very well. Hello, Scott Colley.
G'day, guys. How are we going?
Saw a really cool thing on Car Expert website recently, Scully. The Ford F-150 Lightning. Wow, what an incredible vehicle.
So, yeah, the F-150 Lightning, Ford has actually used that badge before, but it was on a supercharged V8 version of the F-150 truck. So it was a gas-guzzling performance monster. And they've brought it back to life on the cleanest, greenest F-150 it's ever done. The thing that really got me about the F-150 Lightning is the pricing. This thing is a rival to the Rivian R1T, the Tesla Cybertruck, but you'll be able to get your hands on one for the equivalent of $53,000 Australian dollars in the US, and that's before you consider any tax incentives. And you'll be able to pay up to about $130,000, $140,000 for it is what we're gathering, depending on which model, which spec, that sort of thing. But it looks like an F-150, but it's got a really usable electric range up to about 500 kilometres, and the fast one will hit 100 k's an hour in 4.5 seconds. So whoever said electric utes are coming to steal the weekend hasn't seen this one.
We saw President Joe Biden actually driving one, having a great time behind the wheel for a nice publicity stunt. It's also got a massive frunk or a front trunk that you can store tons of things in and can act as a generator for work sites and building sites and things like that. Looking at the pricing, under 40 grand US starting price, the average transaction price of a full-size pickup in America of just a regular petrol one is more than 50 grand US. So this thing is crazy cheap. Given that the F-Series is the biggest selling vehicle in the United States of any variety, clearly Ford is selling this one probably at cost almost at that base price, because it's a really sharp way to actually get your EV volumes up and to build awareness of EVs in general, because the F-Truck is just everywhere. So, this for me is probably just about the most important EV ever built, because if this works, then, EVs in general are home free.
Follow.
I suppose Ford also does have the advantage of the fact the F-150 is the best-selling vehicle in the USA. And because electric cars are usually expensive to build, they're expensive to buy because you can't soak up those development costs. But if it's selling 11 billion F-150s every year, paying a little bit more to build the electric car and soaking up some of that cost is more doable across the range of F-150, Lariat, Raptor, all the really expensive variants that it makes a lot of money on.
Do you reckon we're going to get it?
I wouldn't have thought so. I'm willing to be proven wrong, Mike, but I don't think it's likely to come to Australia.
I reckon some of those aftermarket importers will probably bring a few in as a special edition priced at 250 grand, just like they're doing the Hummer EV. I mean, this is a growing industry, isn't it? We've got the Rivian, we've got the Hummer EV, we've got the F-Series EV. I'm assuming there'll be an EV Toyota Tundra at some point. I mean, this is where a lot of that emphasis is going. They'll come to Australia, but not in Ford dealers through official channels, because like all those big trucks, they'll be left-hand drive only from the factory, I'd be sure of it. Anyway, I don't want to bog us down too much before we get cracking on the episode in general, but there's another Ford thing, guys, that I saw this morning that I really wanted to flag. Will Stop Ford wrote a story, Ford patents in-car advertisements. So basically, front-mounted cameras, we know that they can provide you extremely important information for your active safety systems. They can tell you what the speed limit in a certain area is. They can brake the vehicle if the car in front stops. But technically speaking, they can also identify billboards and display elements of that signage on the car's infotainment system. And Ford has filed a patent in the US to the United States Patent and Trademark Office requesting ownership of exactly that. So we've already kind of seen Google Maps toying with this. You see like your Macca's logo on your Google Maps screen when you're using Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. But imagine if Ford takes these cameras that it uses for good, which is AEB systems and road sign assist systems, and uses them for evil, which is advertising. Not really evil, of course, but a bit of hyperbole there. But, you can really see how this could be a pretty lucrative revenue stream going forward. Ford and other brands, but if Ford gets the patent, they would obviously lead it, actually able to charge companies advertising to display their products and services in a car, depending on where you are. Feeling a bit tired? hey, your car might say, hey, there's a Macca's just up the road with a McCafe. Why don't you pull over and get yourself a coffee? Like, I can easily see this happening, right?
Just to be clear, this segment is not sponsored by Macca's or McCafe, despite the repeat mentions.
Maybe I should have had a snack before the podcast because I'm feeling a bit peckish and I'm a classy guy. But this I can so see this coming. And then, you know, you go down the rabbit hole of, well, do we end up with, you know, ad blocking software for cars? And is that a patch get? Like, it's this whole new world of things opening up, and I just think it's fascinating, and I reckon within a few years we're going to start to see this in earnest.
I hate it so much.
Why?
Because the car is one of the only places where you have any freedom from this stuff anymore. And even in a modern car with a ton of screens and everything, if I don't want to listen to ads on the radio, I can flick to Triple J, or I can, you know, listen to a podcast I know doesn't have ads, or control my music. It's a space that we still own. And the idea of the car being able to override that and play ads just because Ford wants to make some cash from Macca's, it just feels like an invasion of one of the last spaces we're free of digital targeting in a way that, in a way that really kind of sucks, I think, for want of a better term.
I really want to see car brands buy this. So if you're in a Ford, you're driving your, you know, new generation Ford Escape down Parramatta Road or Punt Road, wherever you live, and suddenly like a Toyota ad pops up and says, have you considered the RAV4? There's a deal of 500 metres up the road. They'll do you a good trade-in. I can really see that sort of thing happening as well, maybe. Who knows?
So Porsche actually at Melbourne Airport a couple of years ago did a trial where if there was a camera on the billboard and it would see you were driving a Porsche and put up a display saying, nice choice. So it was active advertising, but the other way, it would recognise the car, not the car recognising it.
Oh, God. Well, interesting times ahead. So we've already gone into a little bit of news a bit early, so we'll get into this week's proper news now. Over to you, Scully. Porsche have developed an app that allows owners to sell their used cars to dealers. Is this a first?
I don't know that it's a first, because people have been trading cars in for a long time. So the idea of used cars going to dealers isn't new, but the way that Porsche is taking control of that is. Something we've seen on the back of COVID, with supply shortages, with manufacturing troubles, is that a lot of car makers have more people wanting to buy their cars than actual cars there are to buy. If you're Kia or you're a Toyota or someone like that, you can obviously ask people to wait, but there's a lot of choice in the mainstream segment where they can wander off and buy something else. But if you want a Porsche 911, you kind of just want a Porsche 911. So one of the focuses for some of these brands is now building their approved pre-owned sort of sections of their business, so that if you do walk in the door and want a 911 but don't want to wait 12 months for a new one in your exact spec to arrive, the Porsche dealer can say, well, we've got this one. It's 3 years old. It's been checked over by a factory technician. It's got a 12-month warranty. How about that as your starting point? And when your new 911 arrives, maybe you can trade it in. And what this app does is essentially allows the owners to more easily sell their cars to a dealer that wants it. So once you take a photo and list it, I think there's 14 Porsche centres that have access to it, and they can accept and make an offer straight away on the car. Once you accept, you can actually talk to them about the logistics of it. But it not only does it make it easier for people who want to see what their car's worth on a trade-in, it makes it easier for Porsche dealers to control the supply of quality Porsche cars coming back into the approved pre-owned system for them to then resell and make money on again and fill a gap that maybe new cars can't fill. So it's pretty savvy from Porsche, and it's actually, I think it's a Porsche first. It's been developed by Porsche Australia. It's not a head office thing. It's clearly a gap in the business they've seen fit to jump into and try out. And I think, knowing not all that many Porsche owners, but a couple of them, the idea of being able to take a photo of your car, see what it's worth, and then, you know, move it on pretty quickly without having tire kickers come and try to take it for a spin around the block is a pretty
appealing
one.
Is this still available? Yeah. All that sort of stuff, yeah.
Can you do it for $850 in a slab?
On a side note, do you reckon our friends from Car Sales ran that story?
I am not sure, actually. I'd be lying if I said I'd looked, but I'd be curious.
Because isn't it interesting that we've got, you know, car brands and OEMs now trying to centralize and own the transaction experience, not just for new vehicles, but for used ones as well. I think you can bigger picture this and see that clearly this is a lucrative market that big OEMs want to tap into.
I think at risk of bigging up one of our big editorial rivals, if it were me, I'd be listing my car on the Porsche app on Car Sales and taking it to another dealer to have a look and really playing the field as much as I can. And that is the great thing about doing it all through your phone. You can make 3 ads and pay a pretty limited amount of money to do it. It's free on the Porsche app. And you can just see where your best offer is.
Oh, I paid you guys $300,000 for a 911 and you were generous enough to let me use your app for free to list my car. They're so generous, these guys.
All right. A car that we're pretty excited to get in Australia very soon, the 2022 Toyota Land Cruiser 300 series. We've seen details leaked this week, Moko.
Yeah, it's been a long burn, this one. We've been getting bombarded with questions from readers for months, even years, about when the hell are we going to see the new Land Cruiser? Well, it's pretty much out in the open now. The official reveal still hasn't been staged, but there's been that many, you know, teaser pictures, spy pictures, people who've captured Land Cruisers in the wild, and we know exactly what it's going to look like. Much brasher and bolder up the front, but pretty evolutionary in terms of the way it looks. Now, we know that it's going to lob here in the first quarter of 2022, although it's going to get revealed in general this year. And the big news, of course, is the engine. So the V8 diesel is dead, as we expected, and it's going to be replaced by a 3.3-litre turbo diesel V6 with 30 kilowatt and 50 newton meters more than the Bent 8 engine that goes away. So just because you've lost 2 cylinders, don't go thinking that you don't have as much capability. There's also a turbo petrol V6 with more than 300 kilowatts of power. 10-speed automatic transmission is expected with a 3.5-ton towing capacity. Dimensionally very similar to the outgoing car, but I think it's a much more, rounded design. I quite like the way that they've made it look. It's a bit butcher, a bit tougher, a bit more upright. Obviously, the old silhouette was fairly ubiquitous, so it's nice to see a slight change. There's going to be some spec levels called GXR and ZX, at least in the information that we've managed to get our hands on, although we don't really know pricing and specs for the Aussie market just yet. But there's no doubt that we know a heck of a lot more about this car than we did even just a few weeks ago. And so you can clearly see that, you know, this vehicle looks like it's going to do everything that its predecessor did, just with a slightly more high-tech focus. And given some of the prices we've seen run out 200 series Land Cruisers going for, you know, we've got this perfect storm at the moment of huge demand for vehicles that can tow a caravan because people can't go overseas, coupled with short supply, coupled with the fact that the current Land Cruiser is at the end of its life cycle, you've got a perfect storm. And there are people on the classifieds asking for $180,000 plus for their Sahara 200 series. So I think the best thing that the 300 series is going to do, it's going to restore a bit of normality. As long as Toyota can get stock of this thing, it's going to take away that silly hyperinflated market that we've been seeing and actually restore a sense of normality. So it can't come soon enough.
Now, moving on to a bit more of a sporty sort of car, Scully, we've seen the 2022 BMW 2 Series being teased for the first time. I love the photos they've taken of this. It's wild and wet and very drifty.
It is. So the 2 Series badge is a bit of a weird one in the BMW world because it's been applied to everything from the little compact two-door rear-wheel drive coupe that we love. It's been applied to a Grand Coupe, which is just BMW speak for a slightly more stylish sedan. And it's been applied to a little front-wheel drive people mover in Europe as well. But the 2 Series we're talking about here is the one that we actually really care about. It's the 2 Series that's going to be built on the same underpinnings as the 3 Series. And we know now that the range-topping model will have all-wheel drive and 275 kilowatts from its 3-litre inline-six engine. Given the 3 Series with the same engine does 0 to 100 kilometres an hour in 4.4 seconds, the smaller, lighter 2 Series is going to be properly rapid. It's going to be really quick. The photos that BMW supplied, the car going sideways is on a wet skid pan because it's all-wheel drive, and I would imagine maybe it's not as keen to do that on dry tarmac, but we know that these bones will form the basis of the next M2. Mandy, I know you've driven the current M2 and you absolutely love it. So fingers crossed whatever's going on there to let that all-wheel drive M240i get sideways on the wet skid pan just sets us up for another little power-packed, compact turbo sports sensation of an M2 because, that car is still beloved by enthusiasts.
On a far more prosaic note, I loved the shout out you just gave to the 2 Series Active Tourer, the MPV people mover, the first front drive BMW. One of my early car launches that I went on way back in the day was to Austria, back when car journalists actually traveled the world for silly launches. We're going back, I'm showing my age now. But because it was the first front-wheel drive BMW, they really wanted to put on a good show, you know. And so they actually lifted this thing on a specially modified gondolier up the side of Mount Solden, a ski resort, and took it all the way to the top of the mountain, so high up that you couldn't really breathe properly. And it was the first time I ever drove a manual car in left-hand drive. So it's quite a memorable launch for me. And I think I'm about the only Australian that actually gives a damn about the fact that there was a front-wheel drive 2 Series MPV offered for about 3 seconds there, because I attached such memories to it. So I loved that shout out, Scully. It took me back.
There you go. That's definitely why I did it, and not just for context. It is interesting though, in the context of BMW, that it created these even numbered coupe badges to separate the cars better. The 4 Series is there because people were maybe slightly confused by 3 Series coupe. The 6 Series is a coupe, 5 Series. The 8 Series is a luxurious 7 Series coupe, essentially. But the 2 Series badge has been bastardized in a way that maybe you wouldn't have expected from what is like a brand new nameplate that's only been recently dreamed up. It's been slapped on all sorts of things. So here's hoping that the car that we're talking about here, the new 2022 M240i, is the standard bearer for the new 2 Series name, and it sets the path going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, we touched on American trucks in the intro. We're going to touch on some more now. Okay, the 2021 Ram 1500 DT. We've got the deets for this.
Yeah, so the DT is the new generation Ram 1500. So Ateco, an organization that distributes Renaults, among other brands, imports Rams as part of a factory agreement with FCA, and then it contracts the Walkinshaw Group through its brilliant conversion factory down here in Melbourne to turn them into right-hand drive. And it's had massive sales success so far, with the previous iteration of the Ram 1500. Kicks off at 80 grand, offers a Hemi V8. That tagline, "Eats Utes for Breakfast," obviously resonates. And it's doing great guns. You see them everywhere. I'm not sure if the average person who buys them really needs them, but that's another argument. So this is the new one. And they're actually going to sell the old and the new concurrently, because in America, Ram still sells the old one for a lot cheaper. And so the old one will remain available at that 80 grand starting price point. But this new one called DT is a massive step up. It's going to take on the Chevy Silverado that Walkinshaw also converts itself and sells through what were HSV dealers, but what are now GMSV dealers. And the 1500 Laramie kicks off at 115 grand and tops out at 140 grand. So it is quite a step up, but contextually, that's about the same price as that Silverado that I just mentioned. So what is this rocking? It's got a naturally aspirated Hemi V8 with 291 kilowatts, but it also has a 48-volt mild hybrid system, so uses a bit less fuel. The claim is still 12.2 litres every 100 k's in the combined cycle, but for a massive petrol V8, you know, pickup, that's actually not terrible. For a bit of context in terms of size, this thing is 500 millimetres longer overall than a Ford Ranger Raptor. Its brake towing capacity at 4.5 tonne is 1,000 kilos more than any of those diesel dual cabs like the Ranger and Hilux that we know of. It's absolutely loaded with all of the active safety equipment you can think of, and it's bloody well equipped too. I mean, these things are essentially luxury SUVs with tubs on the end. The limited top-of-the-range one even has air suspension and a panoramic sunroof. So, like, we're talking pretty crazy features for a pickup truck. And it's got a massive Tesla-style portrait-oriented center touchscreen, you know, 20-speaker Harman Kardon sound system. So it's a proper luxury experience. And I got to say, it looks bloody good too. They look tough, these things. So great to see that, you know, I remember when these companies first started talking about converting pickup trucks in Australia and then selling them, I thought, you know, that's surely not going to be a viable market moving forward. There might be a few blokes who really want a big, tough American pickup, but who's going to pay, you know, 120, 130 grand? But they're doing so well. Clearly there's a hell of a lot of people that want them. And yeah, Ram's capitalizing. So good on.
There's a huge amount of crossover between the spec sheet of the 1500 and of the S-Class we drove recently.
the S-Class.
I know it sounds absolutely ridiculous. But if I were to read to you, like, 12-inch touchscreen infotainment system, 19-speaker Harman Kardon sound system,
totally.
Heated and ventilated front seats, heated rear seats, power tailgate,
and you know what,
suspension, all that stuff.
And like I said before, people are asking 180 grand for Land Cruiser Saharas at the moment. I mean, technically they're 140 drive away at list price, but they're getting marked up. But even if you're paying the recommended amount, which is 140 grand, I would argue that a Ram 1500 with RAM boxes in the back and all that equipment and a massive V8 engine is probably a better buy. Like, it's actually, if you put it in its proper context, it's actually not such a silly idea if you're a certain sort of buyer.
True, true. Hit the news link at carexpert.com.au if you want to read more about those stories. The 2021 Audi Q2 and finally the SQ2 has made it to Australia. Scully, you've driven both of them. First things first, what sort of car is the Q2 and SQ2?
So the Q2 is the cheapest Audi you can buy in Australia at the moment if you want an SUV. You can get an A1 for cheaper, but this is essentially a cute little city SUV aimed at people who want a premium badge, and there are a lot of them out there, but don't necessarily want to stretch to a top spec Q3 or a bigger Q5. It's kind of a my first luxury SUV, essentially.
What are the prices?
So the Q2 starts at just over $40,000. You pay $42,990 for the front wheel drive 35 TFSI, which has the same outputs as an entry level Golf. You then pay $49,990 before on-road costs for the 40 TFSI Quattro S-Line, which got a bit more power, all-wheel drive, a bit more standard equipment. And the range-topping SQ2 is $64,400. Once you start adding options, those prices change, obviously. You can add about $10,000 worth of packages to both the 35 and the 40 TFSI, but there are no options on the SQ2. So if you do start adding bits and pieces to the 40, it might just be worth looking at the SQ2.
So I'm assuming the SQ2 is the performance model over the standard Q2, right?
The SQ2 is the fast one. So this has been out in Europe for a little while. It was revealed in 2019 with the pre-facelift car, but Australia couldn't get its hands on it until this facelift actually rolled around. And under the skin, it's not quite exactly a Golf R, but if you were to picture a Golf R in a sort of slightly taller Audi body, you're pretty much on the money. Moko was talking about green Kias before. This is a green Audi because you can get it in a beautiful shade of apple green as pictured on the website.
No way. What's under the bonnet of these?
The entry-level 35 TFSI has a 1.5-litre four-cylinder engine with 110 kilowatts of power and 250 newton metres of torque. It's front-wheel drive only, and that engine will be familiar, those outputs will be familiar to anyone who's sort of read a little bit about the Volkswagen Group because they're pretty standard entry-level Volkswagen, Skoda, Audi numbers. The 40 TFSI has got a 2-litre engine with 140 kilowatts and 320 newton metres, and it's all-wheel drive only. And both those cars use a 7-speed dual-clutch auto. The SQ2 has a 2-litre 4-cylinder petrol engine that makes 221 kilowatts and 400 newton metres of torque. Jeez. So those are the same numbers that I think Europe got previously in the SQ2, but it's actually more than we've previously gotten from that engine. Volkswagen Group used to consider Australia a hot weather market, which meant we got a detuned version designed to deal with the desert, essentially. But after a bit of lobbying, the Volkswagen Group convinced head office in Germany that the people who actually buy these cars don't live in Cooper Pedy, they live by the beach, and we can have the full fat outputs. And that's what's happened here. So it's got a 7-speed dual clutch auto, it's got a quattro all-wheel drive system, and it'll do 0 to 100 in 4.9 seconds, which is pretty impressive performance for a little car.
Yeah, absolutely. How does it drive?
So, I mean, the base Q2 to start with, if I were to say to you, entry-level Volkswagen Group, you've probably got a pretty good idea about how it drives because these cars all have a fairly familiar feel to them. Not necessarily a bad thing, though, because it feels really, really solid. The base Q2, that engine is smooth and quiet and pretty refined for a small four-cylinder engine, and those outputs are more than you get in more expensive versions of the BMW X1 and X2 and even the entry-level Mercedes GLA. So although it's the smallest Q2 engine and it's less expensive than any of those cars, it's not underpowered by any means. What you really notice with the entry-level car is that it just feels a bit entry-level inside. So there's no door trims, it's just hard black plastic. You don't get the little, Audi calls them fingernails, but silver trim pieces on the window switches. And you just miss out on little bits and pieces like that. You also notice that when you really put your foot down at highway speeds, it doesn't really have the grunt to get you up and moving in the same way that bigger car does. Usually these city cars are launched in the city, but Audi actually launched these cars out on the outskirts of Canberra. So most of my time in the 35 was spent at 100 k's an hour, which showed that it's pretty quiet on good roads. It's pretty noisy on coarse chip roads, as is often the case with entry-level Euro stuff. And when you really put your foot down, it'll get up and going, but it needs to work quite hard. the 40 TFSI kind of changes that. It's a really, really nice engine, that 2-liter. And just that extra bit of punch you get means that you can lean on it and it doesn't need to drop down a gear and work as hard. And when you're really in a hurry, it'll chase the red line more happily and goes harder. So if you're in a bit of a hurry, and the way that you see a lot of these small SUVs driven in the city, these people are in a hurry, the 40 TFSI might be a better bet. The other benefit is all-wheel drive. And if you are buying an SUV and you want to take it up to the snow, or you know, just want to feel a bit more confident on wet roads, even though front-wheel drive is fine, having all-wheel drive is better again. The ride in both these cars is surprisingly good. They're little cars on big wheels, but they're actually quite comfortable over, you know, nasty Aussie back roads and that sort of thing. They don't have adaptive dampers or anything like that, but they don't really need them, which is pretty impressive. The one that you really want to know about, though, is the SQ2, because that's a car that I think a lot of people in Oz have been curious about. I think for starters, it's really, really good value. At $64,400, it undercuts an X2 M35i and a GLA 35 AMG. Wow. It's a little smaller than those cars inside. It's a little bit older underneath than those cars as well. So it's not a perfect match, but in terms of the performance you get, it's very, very close. And when you put your foot down, you really feel that it's a big engine in a small car. It's got heaps of traction and it's just got that Golf R kind of feeling of it'll go really quickly in any conditions with anyone behind the wheel.
Does it sound good?
It sounds surprisingly good. It's got some really good cracks and farts and noises when you shift gears. It also has a nice sort of bassy burble in the cabin when you put it in sport mode. But like a lot of that Volkswagen stuff, there is a bit of cleverness going on with the speakers. So there's noise being piped in when you want it to be loud. But the benefit of that is when you're going quietly or cruising, it's not as noisy in the cabin.
$65,000 isn't that much more than what the new gen Golf 8R is going to cost.
Yes.
I think that's pretty much bang on what the next Golf 8R could cost.
And don't get me wrong, that'll be a bigger car with newer tech. But this is an Audi. It's got quattro all-wheel drive, Haldex style all-wheel drive, which is synonymous with that brand. It looks awesome. I still think the Q2 is one of the best looking small SUVs ever made. Certainly looks better than that bloody BMW X2 thing. And it just, I don't know, it just seems like Audi has really nailed this one. You know, sometimes you look at a price and spec story and it just seems that the product planners got it right in terms of the amount of features you get, the performance, the price, all up, it just looks like a bloody compelling thing.
I think you're bang on. And I think when you look at the standard equipment list on this car, we're used to entry-level Euro stuff, even the performance stuff, looking really good on paper until you start adding options. And then all of a sudden, your $65,000 Audi is an $85,000, $90,000 Audi. That's just not the case here. Pretty much everything is standard. And when I say everything, I mean like down to red and black quilted leather bucket seats inside, the virtual cockpit cabin. You can also choose a black trim for the seats, because not everyone's into red and black. But pretty much everything you look at is what you get. You get keyless entry and start, leather seats, wireless phone charging, automatic everything, dual zone climate, even the good wheels, 19-inch alloys are standard. Adaptive cruise, which you don't get standard on the more expensive X2. The seats are Nappa leather as well. They're not just the normal stuff. So, yeah, pretty much anything you could possibly want, you get. The only options are privacy glass and a panoramic sunroof. And I'd argue neither of those are essential. So you look at that $64,400 and you go, not only is it a good starting price, it's what you'll actually likely pay before on-road costs, which is unusual.
So an SQ2 or a base Kia Niro EV, as much as my heart lies with the environmentally friendly vehicle, that really does show how far EVs have to go to become price competitive, right? Because it's no slight on Kia. Every EV with that sort of range costs that sort of money. It's not like Kia is gouging, quite the opposite. But it just shows the cost differences in the production of these things, because that SQ2 is better equipped, faster, has a more desirable badge, and it costs the same money. I actually reckon that's a really interesting kind of side-by-side.
I sense a new comparison coming up, Michael.
maybe not quite that one, but maybe an on-paper one.
I think the only thing, besides the fact it's now a direct rival for the Kia Niro, that's worth noting about the SQ2 and the Q2 in general is that although it's quite affordable on paper for a luxury car, and although it comes with quite a lot of standard kit, it is now a generation old compared to some other Audi stuff. And the one place you notice that is inside. It doesn't drive all that differently necessarily, but it's still got the older rotary controller on the transmission tunnel and an older infotainment system. it's still a really sharp system. I actually quite like the rotary controller, and I love that you've got proper little beautiful metal click-clacky dials for the climate control like Audi used to do. But some people are going to sit in this car and go, oh, it feels a little bit old. And that is the one drawback of the Q2. Although the SQ2 is new to Australia, it's not a new car, and Audi's made some big steps that haven't been transferred to this car inside.
I'm so with you though, Scully. I love Audi's old interiors. The new ones, they're all screens and that's fine. But, you know, these haptic control pad screens for the ventilation, I don't think the material quality is quite as, you know, amazing as it used to be. The old ones with their knurled, you know, knobs and dials, and everything was perfectly weighted and it felt like it was, you know, hewn out of one solid piece of granite almost. I feel like new Audi's focus on tech, which is what customers want, but the old Audis have a certain kind of tactile charm to them, and it sort of sounds like the SQ2 is the last of that breed. Maybe Audi will, you know, come back full circle with its next generation of products, but it does feel like that old interior is actually almost a selling point to me.
It definitely is, and I've actually said in the review of both the Q2 and the SQ2 that inside it's just a previous gen A3, and when that previous gen A3 came out, we were blown away by it because it was essentially an Audi TT cabin. The Q2 doesn't, unfortunately, get the screen that folds mechanically into the dashboard, because that was a really, really cool feature in the A3. Yeah. That button just turns the screen off in the Q2. But this is essentially a previous gen A3 inside, and we spent years raving about that interior, so it's pretty cool that it lives on in some form.
Yeah. We need to have a word at the word to those tight asses at Ingolstadt to, you know, for taking out that retractable screen feature. Probably saved them about 40 euro cents. Which would add up.
Then again, it's one less thing that can break too, I suppose. But
true that.
As much as
true
it
that.
Was
spoken
cool.
Spoken like a true old German car aficionado that you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Man who's got experience in this field.
Those reviews are live at the site. So if you want to head over there and take a look. Marco, the 2021 Kia Niro, you've driven this car. It comes with hybrid, plug-in, electric power, all that sort of stuff, but not a petrol option or even a diesel if you're more of that inclined. This is an interesting move from Kia.
It is. It also triggers my interest in the Roman Empire because it reminds me of the evil emperor Nero who fiddled while the city burned. But anyway, I'm digressing. So, yeah, look, it's a bit like the Hyundai Ioniq in a sense, isn't it, that it comes in a choice of three different electrified drivetrains. And the message to market is, well, maybe you're not ready for a full EV. Maybe you just want a hybrid. Maybe you want the FEV that sort of sits in between and tries to kind of play in both camps. And the company can offer you whichever you want. Now, this is actually a fairly old car. It launched in 2016. It got updated in 2019. We're getting the update here, and it's coming right at the end of its life cycle. In fact, there's a brand new Niro expected next year that will look a lot like a concept car called Habanero that we saw in 2019. So we're getting this car at the end. Kia has got form. It did that the same thing for the first iteration of Picanto as well. Basically, reading between the lines, Kia just couldn't get supply of this car. We know that car brands don't want to send green vehicles to Australia because why would they? The market here for them is tiny and there's no incentives. So it took Kia a long time to get this product, but it has now. I was given the keys ahead of the launch to the electric one, the Niro Electric, which of course is the most interesting of all three because it's Kia's first EV and it's one of the longest range affordable EVs that are out there. So it kicks off just over 60 grand and it tops out at 65,990 before on-road costs, which makes it eligible for Victoria's $3,000 subsidy. But like all EVs, it ain't cheap. So for context, a Kona Electric Elite is 66 grand, a Nissan Leaf E Plus extended range is 60.5 grand. And perhaps the real smoky here is a base Tesla Model 3 standard range plus is now just 62,900 before on-road costs because it's coming out of China now, which makes it much cheaper to import and sell. And then you've got other options like the Mazda MX-30 EV Astina. MX-30 Astina at 65.5, the Mini Electric at 55.5, and the BMW i3. The real value leader in that is the MG ZS-EV at 44 drive away. But what the Niro offers is range. It's got 450 kilometres of driving range, which is equal to the Kona Electric because they share 64 kilowatt hour battery packs. And there is basically no affordable EV that can sort of match that. The base Tesla goes close. The Leaf extended range is 385Ks. But if you're somebody who has range anxiety, this Niro is definitely worth having a look at. It's got 150 kilowatt, 395 newton meter front motor driving those front wheels through a single speed transmission. And given the consumption of 16 kilowatt hours per 100 Ks, that range is very feasible. I actually swung down to a DC charger, a ChargeFox DC charger, and was able to add about 120 Ks of range in 30 minutes. It was drawing down 46 kilowatts of charge pretty consistently from that DC charger. So, you know, we're getting to the point now where the infrastructure is being useful. You can also organize a home wall box for about $3,000 that charges at 7 kilowatts, and that'll top you up overnight in about 9 hours' time. I did a 7.8 second 0-100 sprint, so it's pretty pokey, a bit like the Kona Electric. It actually spins the front wheels and chirps them and, you know, flies off the line because you get all that torque delivered instantly in EVs. And aside from the spaceship hum that it makes at low speeds to tell pedestrians that it's around, once you're up and running, it's actually dead silent, super fast, super smooth. And, you know, unlike other Kias, this doesn't have the Aussie suspension tune because it is quite an old car. But it still drives pretty well. You know, you can't hide the fact that it's got 450 kilos of batteries in the floor, which certainly makes the suspension work. But as an urban commuter, in terms of, you know, nice light steering, nice sort of relatively good body control through corners, it certainly does a good job. You've got four levels of brake regeneration that you can cycle through using the paddle shifters. And of course, you can also do one pedal driving like a Leaf, meaning you can use brake regen to bring the car to a complete stop. It's also super practical. So in terms of size, it sits about between the Kona and the Leaf, but it definitely is more in line with the latter in terms of practicality. I carried four adults quite regularly in it. I did a few airport runs, picking up some friends, and was able to fit a few suitcases in the back. 450-litre boot is nothing to sneeze at. So compared to that sort of pokey Kona, it's very practical. Inside, you get a 10-inch touchscreen that's running the latest infotainment system. It pinches and zooms and swipes just like a smartphone. You can look at multiple menus, full digital instrument display. So it's relatively high-tech inside. Looks a bit dull, I have to say. It's not the most exciting looking car in the world, but then neither is a Nissan Leaf, is it? Never really stopped anybody. I think there's a really solid argument that of all those, and I say this with a sort of cringe, but all of those legacy brands, as they're called, all of the well-known car manufacturers, this is probably for me the most compelling of those 65 grand-ish EVs that are out there at the moment. I think it's a bit more practical and useful than a Kona. Its range is a bit longer than a Leaf. It definitely delivers more value for money than a Mazda MX-30. As much as I like that MG ZS-EV and how affordable it is a bit rough around the edges and has a short range. What it also shows, you know, is just how bloody good a base Tesla Model 3 is, you know. I mean, a Tesla Model 3 for the same money as a Kia Niro? God, you're kidding me, right? But, you know, that Tesla aside, I think it makes a pretty good first start. Perhaps more importantly, it gives Kia, you know, a genuine presence in that green car market, which it hasn't had up till now. One of Australia's fastest growing car brands with nothing electrified whatsoever in its range. Well, this Niro has basically, you know, changed that in one fell swoop. So it's quite an important car for the brand. And, you know, I wish them well. I think it's a relatively good offering. I think like all EVs, it's too expensive, but I guess, you know, that's just the nature of new technology, right? And aside from this sort of dullness to it, I kind of enjoyed it. So a relatively compelling product indeed.
Moco, this is built on a legacy petrol or diesel chassis. It's an electric car that's been squeezed into a petrol car's body, essentially. Kia has the EV6 coming later this year, which is built on Hyundai and Kia's new fully electric architecture, and it's got faster charging and all sorts of things. One of the questions I think we're getting a lot at the experience center is, should I buy something like the Niro that feels like the end of an era, or is it worth waiting for a fully electric from the ground up car? Where do you sit on that, given the Niro is not exactly cheap?
Yeah, well, there's a brand new Niro coming next year too, isn't there? So the line that I tend to give people is, if you're somebody who has a very strong environmental conscience and you're somebody who has some disposable income, then you should make the leap now, because you can actually be the change you want to see in the world, to use a hackneyed phrase. You can actually bring about, you know, what you want in automotive. But, you know, if you're an average person who's counting every penny at the moment, then no, don't buy an EV for 65 grand because it's too expensive. So it does really depend on who you are. There's no doubt that the new Niro and, of course, the EV6 that you mentioned, Scully, with its 800-volt charging infrastructure, will be a far better car. more modern, more contemporary, more expensive too, probably. Like the nature of any technology, it's the same as the first plasma screen TVs that cost 10 grand. You know, the real hardcore techno type people bought them straight away, and average people sort of watched and waited until they could afford them. And with cars, people will probably just buy Corolla hybrids to tide themselves over for 25 grand and then wait until EVs come down in price. I think, yeah, ultimately it's probably a fairly limited audience for that car, considering we don't have tax breaks and subsidies and CO2 caps and mandates in place in Australia. Not the most propitious market for EVs to take off. So I don't think this moves the goalposts to that degree. I think it's good that Kia has representation in that space, but if you're an average mum or dad buyer, no, you'd probably watch and wait.
So what rating did you give it, Moko, for our car expert rating?
Yeah, so pros, I've praised its 450k range, its big back seats and boot, and its sprightly acceleration mixed with nice urban steering. And its cons, it looks dull next to a Kona Electric. The base grade has halogen headlights. Are you kidding me? In 2021? And the EV variants lack an ANCAP crash rating. They're my negatives. In terms of overall rating, I'm very solid 8.2 out of 10. Which I think is pretty reflective of where this car is. It's not a game changer, but among those EVs that are currently on sale, it's certainly one of the best.
Yeah, that review is live at carexpert.com.au if you want to check it out. Alrighty, that's an end to this week's podcast. A list of events and launches that we've got coming up next week. Scully, what have we got?
It's a much quieter week next week after a fairly hectic couple, but Tony Crawford has managed to find a way to get an Aston Martin DBX off-road. That'll be up in Sydney next week. We've also got a fair spread of people up at the Car Expert Experience Centre. So Mike will be up there from the end of next week if you want to go in and say hello to him. And then, yeah, coming into the weeks after that, things pick up again with Toyota Kluga Drive, Genesis G70, which I'm really looking forward to hearing about, and the new Kia Cerato and Golf Mark 8 as well. So they're on the horizon, but it's a quieter week for people travelling around, thankfully.
Marco, what cars have we got coming up next week?
Well, I'm currently doing a comparison test with a Prado and an Everest, Ford Everest and Toyota Prado, which is, you know, neither of them are the most new and exciting cars in the world, but it's quite interesting. We have a Peugeot 2008 GT Sport here. In Sydney, we've got the Volkswagen Tiguan 162 TSI R-Line, which is a new, or I should say an updated model. Next week, we've got some interesting fodder as well. So there's two comparisons happening out of Melbourne, one being run by me and one that we'll get Scully and James to look after. It's a Ford Focus Active via Mazda CX-30, so two car-like small crossovers. And then there's an EV three-car test, Nissan Leaf E-Plus extended range, Hyundai Kona Electric, and the Kia Niro EV in Sport, guys, that I'll be writing up. So that should be a good insight into the best 65 grand non-Tesla EV that you can buy. And then up in Sydney, we've also got an updated Subaru Forester that our writer Kurt Dupre will be getting through. So plenty of metal for us to be driving over the next few weeks.
Good stuff. Now, if you're new to the Car Expert podcast and you like what you're hearing, give us a rating. We'd love that. Mike Costello and Scott Colley, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks. Good to see you, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.